they have a lot of lawsuits.
Well, we will continue to cover them. I want to thank you so much, Isabel Chowdhury, for joining us, Senior Policy Manager for the National Women's Health Network. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced by an amazing group of people sheltering at home as well as here at the studio. It's produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Rabbi Karen, Hani Masood, Adriana Contreras, and Maria Tarasena. Our general manager is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Miriam Barnard, Paul Powell, Mike DiFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us. Stay safe.
Tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
At KBOO, we think that all communities deserve to be fully informed on the policies and decisions that will impact their lives, and we need your help to make that happen. We're looking for citizen journalists to help collect, report, and broadcast the news. Do you think that there are groups that are underrepresented or marginalized by the mainstream media? Are you aware of social, political, or environmental activities that don't have adequate visibility? Are there important issues in your town or region that aren't getting coverage? This is your chance to give a voice to the voiceless. You don't have to have experience, and you don't have to come into KBOO's Portland studio. You can contribute from wherever you live. If you have some basic writing skills and a desire to get the word out, we want you. Just send an email with your idea and contact information to News Director, that's all one word, newsdirector@kboo.fm, and include the words citizen journalist in the subject line, and the news team will contact you. Once again, send that email to newsdirector@kboo.fm.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, six police accountability measures face vote in the special session. A violent night as protesters attack the North Portland Police Precinct of the Portland Police Bureau. And in national news, the Trump administration continues to push for the repeal of the Affordable Care Act. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, June 26th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. Yesterday, the special session of the Oregon Legislature advanced six police accountability bills. The bills covered a wide range of issues, including a bill to make it difficult for labor arbitrators to overturn police discipline, a statewide database of officers who have had their credentials suspended or revoked, a ban on chokeholds or holds to restrict blood flow, except in situations where deadly force is allowed under state law, a requirement that officers intervene and report excessive force or other specified misconduct by other officers, limitations on the use of tear gas, and the creation of a new legislative committee to propose additional reforms in next year's regular session. Some of the bills were amended to gain consensus, but Portland Democratic Senator Lou Fredericks says that was a sign of progress, that legislation similar to that which he had been proposing for years is finally on the verge of passing. He says the action shows that ingrained practices and actions can change. And as the last of the bills cleared the House Senate committee last night, he told his fellow lawmakers that he was proud to be a part of the group. The bills were scheduled for a floor session in the Senate this morning at 10, followed by a House session at 11, As of our deadline, the vote has not yet been taken. Weeks of mostly peaceful protests gave way to a violent confrontation with Portland police last night. At about 10 p.m., protesters gathered around the Portland Police Bureau's North Precinct on Northeast Martin Luther King Boulevard between Emerson and Killingsworth. Protesters began building a fence across Northeast MLK and throwing objects such as bottles at police. Unconfirmed reports say that demonstrators were attempting to create an autonomous zone around the precinct. After about an hour, police say that protesters began ramming dumpsters into the garage doors of the building in an effort to get in. When that failed, they began barricading exit doors so that officers and others in the building could not get out. At midnight, protesters began shouting that they were going to burn the building down and throwing fireworks at the officers. At 1 a.m., the police declared an unlawful assembly and 20 minutes later started trying to break up the crowd. At that point, police claim that some protesters fired paintball rounds at their face shields. Officers responded with crowd control munitions and tear gas canisters, some of which were picked up and hurled back at them. Before dispersing after 3 a.m., demonstrators were said to have looted a business and set two fires. One fire was set in the street, and the other was to the facade of the Mid-K Beauty Supply, which is in the same building complex as the North Precinct. During a visit to the site this morning, Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler called it, quote, an act of violence that is completely unacceptable. I am disgusted by what I am seeing here. The Portland Police Bureau says that three other officers received minor injuries and a fourth was taken to the hospital. Four arrests were made. Yesterday, Oregon Governor Kate Brown commuted the sentences of 57 medically vulnerable inmates in the state prisons. According to guidelines published by the Department of Corrections, those selected were not considered to present an unacceptable safety, security, or compliance risk to the community. But even though their sentences have been commuted, there are still hurdles the prisoners must clear before they are released. They must have served at least 50% of their sentence and have a record of good conduct for the last 12 months, and they must have a plan for housing and out-of-custody health care in place before they can be released. So far, 13 of the prisoners on the commutation list have those plans. In April, the Department of Corrections provided the governor with a list of hundreds of prisoners who were medically vulnerable. In response to the announcement, the Oregon Justice Resource Center said the number of people whose sentences are being commuted represents only a small fraction of those that are vulnerable to COVID-19. Resource Center spokesperson Alice Lundell said, quote, the release of so few people will do almost nothing to increase the ability of incarcerated people to stay physically distant from one another. Lundell called for additional actions to reduce the spread of COVID-19 in prisons, including an increase in testing rates and a dramatic reduction in prison populations to allow for proper social distancing. A Gresham City Hall employee is under investigation for having a violent racist decal on his car. Field Supervisor Doug Hawley is said to have had a window sticker with the words, "All lives splatter, nobody cares about your protest," on his personal vehicle. The decal depicts a car running people over. Three complaints were filed with the city stating that the bumper sticker was violent and racist. They also said the sticker poorly represented the city of Gresham since Hawley was allegedly on the job while using the truck. After initial complaints, Hawley apparently replaced that decal with a second sticker that showed an image of President Trump holding up his middle finger with the words, "Nobody cares about your protest." The complaints about the window stickers has raised particular concern since they appeared during a month of nationwide protests against racism and police brutality. Gresham city leaders have voiced support for the protests, and the city council voted unanimously to fly the Black Lives Matter flag at City Hall throughout the month of July. Lincoln County officials reversed a policy on Wednesday exempting people of color from wearing face masks in public. The directive, intended to protect vulnerable populations from racial profiling, caused a backlash of racist commentary from near and far. Lincoln County is one of seven Oregon counties that Governor Kate Brown ordered to wear masks starting this past Wednesday. On June 16th, Lincoln County Health Department released its own mask requirements, allowing exceptions for people with medical conditions or disabilities, children under 12, and people of color who have concerns about racial profiling or harassment. Lincoln County officials announced these policy exemptions amidst one of the state's largest COVID-19 outbreaks at the Newport Seafood Processing Plant. The officials say that an article in the New York Post caused a backlash of racist and derogatory comments from around the country, and the commissioners admit that the policy, quote, caused more harm than good. In a statement, county officials said local residents of color called for the policy to be rescinded because it was making them, quote, possible targets for more hate. Lincoln County will maintain its exemptions for people with medical conditions or disabilities and children under 12, but will now require people of color to wear masks in public spaces. Signatures are being collected for a November ballot initiative that would create an independent redistricting commission to fight gerrymandering in Oregon. For more on the story, here's Eric Tegedoff of the Oregon News Service.
Oregon stands out on the West Coast for the way its voting districts are drawn. Unlike neighbors California, Idaho, and Washington, redistricting in Oregon is a political process decided by the party in power. The threat of gerrymandering is high. Executive Director of Common Cause Oregon, Kate Titus, says politicians typically draw districts behind closed doors using elaborate data.
If you move that line over one block and include this block in this district instead of that district, how's it going to affect their political power? So that sophisticated analysis is happening. It's just not open to the public, and that's really the problem.
Titus says a coalition of groups is looking to change that. Signatures are being collected for an initiative to create an independent, nonpartisan redistricting commission. Its backers have until July 2nd to collect about 150,000 signatures. Critics of the idea say creating the commission would leave out some marginalized groups. Titus counters that an independent redistricting commission would invite the public to participate in the process.
It's all out in the open, and it centers around community input, so a lot of public testimony, so that the commission itself is really responding to the needs of communities as the communities themselves see them.
Coronavirus has thrown a wrench into the signature collecting process. Titus says the campaign had to get creative. The coalition known as People Not Politicians mailed petitions to 500,000 households in the state. She says folks can sign it from home, too.
If they had a computer at home, they could print out a petition on their computers, sign it, and mail it in.
She says getting an independent commission passed this year is especially important. Districts are drawn once a decade, and that happens next year using 2020 census data. Support for this reporting was provided by the Carnegie Corporation of New York. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Earlier today, the Oregon Health and Science University, or OHSU, announced that it has terminated its contract to use prison laborers to clean the hospital's laundry, according to a report from Willamette Week. Under agreement between OHSU and Oregon Correction Enterprises, the university had been sending laundry to Oregon State Penitentiary in Salem since 1995. Oregon Corrections Enterprises is a private entity with the Oregon Department of Corrections that manages outside labor contracts. Prison laborers are paid less than $1 per hour for their work. In a statement, OHSU President Dr. Danny Jacobs said, quote, "The foundation on which our prison systems lie and on which programs like laundry services operate are antithetical to our values." A spokesperson for Oregon Correctional Enterprises said they are not obligated to divulge who its 33 clients are, but did admit that the companies using prison labor for their laundry services are almost exclusively hospitals. In April, Willamette Week reported that laundry workers at Oregon State Penitentiary and Two Rivers Correctional Facility were concerned about contracting COVID-19 while cleaning hospital linens. Washington Governor Jay Inslee issued a statewide order requiring the wearing of masks or face coverings in public spaces. The order goes into effect today and requires people to wear masks both indoors and outdoors in the spaces where social distancing cannot be followed. Inslee called the wearing of masks a statement and said, quote, "It means you care about people because it means you want to reduce the risk that you are going to infect another person." Individuals who don't follow the order could face a misdemeanor charge with potential penalties of 90 days in jail and a $1,000 fine. The move came after Yakima County reported a rise in cases and a shortage of both intensive care and non-intensive care hospital beds. The governor stated that the patients were being transported to Seattle and other cities outside Yakima County, risking the spread of coronavirus across the state. Initially, the Yakima County Sheriff's Office issued a statement saying that they would enforce the mandate if needed. But yesterday, Yakima County Sheriff Robert Udell refuted that, saying, quote, "Deputies will not be stopping, detaining, or citing or arresting people who are in public without a face covering." You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast at 5:30. We'll be listening to Counterspin. At 6, it's going to be Hard Knock Radio, then at 7, Rising Up with Sonali. Tonight, we'll see a partly cloudy evening with an overnight low of about 60. Tomorrow will be cloudy with temperatures in the high 60s. On this day, the United Nations Charter was signed by 50 nations at a ceremony in San Francisco. The quote of the day is from former UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, who said, quote, "More than ever before in human history, we share a common destiny. We can only master it if we face it together. And that, my friends, is why we have a United Nations." Of the worst health crisis in the U.S. for 100 years, the Trump administration has joined states in an effort to have Obamacare declared unconstitutional. With more on the story, here's KBOO's Ray Bodwell.
Yesterday, the U.S. confirmed 40,000 new cases of the coronavirus, an all-time high. And just before midnight last night, the Trump administration asked the Supreme Court to overturn the Affordable Care Act, popularly known as Obamacare. In an 82-page brief, the administration joined 17 states in claiming that the elimination of the tax penalty for not buying insurance rendered the law unconstitutional. The removal of the so-called individual mandate was authorized by the Republican-controlled Congress as part of the 2017 tax bill. If the court agrees, it would end Obamacare and wipe out the health insurance for millions of Americans. The suit was initially brought by Texas and has been actively supported by Arizona and Florida, three states that were among the earliest to reopen and now are suffering huge surges in coronavirus cases. Republicans in Congress have long pushed to, quote, repeal and replace the ACA, but have never proposed an alternative. And in 2017, a Senate repeal attempt failed when Arizona Republican Senator John McCain voted no. The Supreme Court has yet to set a date for oral arguments, but they are likely to happen in the fall as Americans prepare to vote in the November general elections. In a statement, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said, quote, "President Trump and the Republicans' campaign to rip away protections and benefits of the Affordable Care Act in the middle of the coronavirus crisis is an act of unfathomable cruelty." She went on to point out that not only would 23 million Americans lose their health insurance, but 130 million Americans would lose their protection from pre-existing conditions. For KBOO, this is Ray Bodwell.
With COVID-19 cases escalating at record rates, the governors of Florida and Texas are closing bars. Both states have Republican governors who were among the first to follow President Trump's demand that states reopen for business. In an April visit to the White House, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis declared victory over the virus. But with nearly 9,000 new cases yesterday, DeSantis ordered the closures. Florida's previous high was 5,500 cases set just 2 days ago, and the state now has 123,000 cases with more than 32,000 confirmed in the last week. Texas governor made his move the day after the state decided to pause reopening amid a soaring number of new cases. In April, Texas Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick caused outrage when he suggested that senior citizens would be willing to die for the U.S. to get back to work. On Wednesday, the Texas Medical Center in Houston announced that they were at 97% of the intensive care unit capacity. The Houston facility is one of the largest medical centers in the country. The Texas Children's Hospital has begun taking care of adults in an expanded special isolation unit to take on some of the overflow. As bad as things are in Texas and Florida, things may be worse in Arizona. Texas is currently recording 464 cases per 100,000 residents, and Florida has 572. The Arizona Department of Health Services website currently reports an astonishing 924 cases per 100,000 residents. The Navajo Nation and White Mountain Apache tribe are still struggling to get the coronavirus under control. With that story and more, it's Megan Kamrick with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Megan Kamrick in for Antonia Gonzalez. The Navajo Nation and White Mountain Apache Tribe continue to brace against a rise in COVID-19 cases across Arizona. Christine Trudeau reports.
The Navajo Nation had a brief period of reduced cases earlier this week, including a day with no new deaths from COVID-19. Even as the rest of the state is struggling to contain the pandemic, on Thursday, Arizona Governor Doug Ducey pleaded with residents to stay home in the wake of a surge of COVID-19 cases that threatens to overwhelm the medical system's ability to handle them. Navajo Nation President Jonathan Nez, meanwhile, said the increase in COVID-19 cases remains, in his words, alarming. But he said it could be attributed to what he says is blitz testing. The reservation has had among the highest per capita rates of coronavirus infections in the nation. This week, they mourn the loss of a 29-year veteran of the tribal police force who died of COVID-19. Navajo officials honored 50-year-old Michael Lee by flying flags at half-staff this week. Nez urged citizens to continue social distancing, wearing face mask coverings, and practicing isolation. As of Thursday, Navajo Nation reported 121 new confirmed cases. White Mountain Apache Tribal Chairwoman Gwendina Lee Gatewood updated tribal citizens this week that the total number of cases of COVID-19 has risen to 1,537 and the total number of deaths to 19. I'm Christine Trudeau.
In what may be a first for the municipality of Anchorage, three Indigenous women will serve on the city's Public Safety Advisory Commission. KNBA's Trip Krause reports on the resolution that passed unopposed Tuesday at a meeting of the Anchorage Municipal Assembly.
The three appointments include Emily Edenshaw, who is the Executive Director of the Alaska Native Heritage Center.
I'm looking forward to rolling up my sleeves and doing good work for our people. It's an honor to serve my community and work alongside these two incredible Native women by my side.
Edenshaw is Yupik and Inupiaq. The other two appointments were Charlene Ogpek Upuk and Kendra Kloster. Upuk, who is Inupiaq, is the Director of Gender Justice at Native Movement. She's also the Executive Director for Data for Indigenous Justice. Kloster is Tlingit and the Executive Director of Native Peoples Action and Native Peoples Action Community Fund. The Public Safety Advisory Commission examines public safety issues and advises the mayor and assembly. It also provides input from various emergency service organizations to identify problems that may arise. In Anchorage, I'm Trip Krause.
Navajo Nation leaders want New Mexico to end efforts to dismiss a landmark education case meant to address educational inequities in the state. President Jonathan Nez and Vice President Myron Leiser released a statement this week opposing a motion to dismiss the Yazzie Martinez lawsuit. Nez says Native students deserve an educational environment that prioritizes their culture and unique needs. A judge ruled in 2018 that New Mexico had denied English language learners, special education, Native American, and low-income students their constitutional right to a sufficient education. These groups make up about three-fourths of the students in New Mexico. The Santa Fe New Mexican reports the state filed a motion in March to dismiss the suit because it claims it has met the requirements of the 2018 decision. The state argues it has earmarked millions of additional dollars for public schools. It also points to policy changes and executive orders to show why the public school system has changed. The New Mexico Center on Law and Poverty, which is representing the Yazzie plaintiffs, argues the state's efforts have been piecemeal. In an op-ed in the Albuquerque Journal, they write that there are still large inequities in access to reliable internet and technology, and they say there's still a lack of culturally and linguistically appropriate instructional materials, and there's a shortage of certified teachers. A judge will hear the motion to dismiss on Monday. For National Native News, I'm Megan Kamrick.
Today, the U.S. House of Representatives will vote on D.C. statehood for the first time in over 30 years. And a new poll of Black Americans show that racism and policing are two of the top issues in their choice of a candidate in the November election. With more on that story and others, it's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
My service in the Congress has been dedicated to achieving equality for the people I represent, which only statehood can provide.
Eleanor Holmes Norton has served in the House for 30 years, but she's a non-voting delegate, not a representative, because she's from Washington, D.C., which is legally a United States territory. The House votes today on a historic bill to make D.C. the 51st state. Ashari James is with March for Our Lives, D.C. She says without voting representation, she has nobody to lobby or truly represent her.
Being a Black woman in America, your voice is naturally silenced. And then to be a Black woman in D.C., where I literally could not vote for people who would fight for me on a personal note, is disappointing and disheartening.
The bill is expected to pass in the House, but President Trump says he'll veto it if it comes to his desk. Last month, he told the New York Post, quote, why? So we can have two more Democrat senators and five more congressmen, unquote. But Janice Lewis-George, a candidate for D.C. Council Ward 4, says President Trump's responses to recent protests just highlight problems with the current structure.
If D.C. were a state, you know, we would be able to push back against the heavily militarized federal presence in the city and, you know, keep the autonomy of our own police force.
Under D.C. law, any president is authorized to command the Metropolitan Police Department.
Unfortunately for us, all we can do is really, you know, hold our mayor accountable to, you know, the deployment of MPD. But when Trump, you know, is able to have that level of power over us, you know, we're really limited in fighting back and not having such a militarized presence in right here in our community.
A new Washington Post Ipsos poll of Black Americans shows racism and policing as the two most important issues in their choice of candidate in November, and 92% of Black registered voters intend to choose former Vice President Joe Biden. On the question of whether it's important for Biden to nominate a Black woman as his running mate, respondents were split 50-49.
I think selecting an African-American woman is really gonna take things to another level, certainly with those in the Black population, honestly. I mean, I would be super excited.
Ramesh Akberi is Tennessee's first African-American state Senate Democratic caucus chair. She says, like the election of Barack Obama, a Black woman VP would bring a greater sense of belonging and acceptance.
And I think now in this time where we really are hopefully facing the true nature of systemic racism and injustice and police brutality, that we can have someone that can continue, that can unite us and kind of repair some things that have happened over these last several years.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Wolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
They may be locked down, but young people can still use social media to drive the climate movement. For more on that, here's Dr. Anthony Leisowitz with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Leisowitz, and this is Climate Connections. 2 years ago, on a cold December day in New York City, then 13-year-old Alexandra Villasenor skipped school, but not because she wanted to sleep in or binge-watch TV.
I ended up going and sitting at this bench in front of the United Nations headquarters here.
Inspired by the young Swedish activist Greta Thunberg, Villasenor went on strike from school to demand action on the climate crisis. That first day, she was alone. But since then, the youth climate movement has grown, and she's been organizing protests with other young leaders in New York City and around the world.
I think that that's one of the things that makes this current movement so strong. Most of our actions that we have, our global actions, are all coordinated through social media. It's how we connect, it's how we meet each other.
So although the COVID-19 pandemic has kept them indoors, Villasenor says it has not slowed them down. Every Friday, they lead online strikes and flood social media with pictures of themselves holding up signs from their kitchens and bedrooms. She says for many young people, leveraging online platforms is nothing new. So even during a pandemic, they're prepared to keep demanding climate action. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, June 26th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast is Hannah Merzbach, Lisa Loving, and Ray Bodwell. The producer is Ray Bodwell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Megan Kamrick, Lily Bolke, and Eric Tegedoff. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBU programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our listeners. If you'd like to support our programming, you can go to kbu.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Thanks so much for listening. Now stay tuned for Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, it's hard to understand how journalists can report Donald Trump's repeated claim that the U.S. should do less coronavirus testing because, quote, with smaller testing, we would show fewer cases, close quote, without following up with, and that's why we're calling for his resignation. Trump's bizarre delusions on COVID-19 aren't just bats in his attic. They've driven a response that is nothing short of disastrous. He's backing up the no test, no disease fallacy, for instance, by cutting funding for testing sites around the country, a move that, Talking Points Memo reports, local officials met with a, quote,